Welcome to the Deer Society Podcast. Here's your host, Brian Lemke.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back. Thanks for tuning in to the Deer Society Podcast. I'm Brian Lemke, joined by Mike and JJ Dukart. I got to forewarn you guys, Mike is drinking coffee this morning for the first time in a long time. So I'm not sure how this is going to go. It might get a little wild. You know Mike, he likes to tell stories. So coffee in him this morning. Get ready. It's going to be an exciting one. But today we're talking about the time of year. In the blink of an eye, if you're watching, you see JJ's wearing some orange. He's got his orange cup out. The orange armies are out in the woods. Gun seasons are opening up all across the country now. It's been in here in Minnesota for quite a bit. But we're kind of getting into that late November period. Things are changing. You know, we're shifting into that post-rut and even beyond that. We have cold temperatures here in the upper Midwest. So we're going to be talking about what we've been seeing out in the woods. And then we're going to also go to our social media. We posted on there for you guys to submit some questions. So we're going to do a little Q&A. We're going to answer some of your questions. So it should be an exciting podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Let's kick it off. You guys have been in the woods quite a bit here recently. This is a time of year that you guys have had a lot of success, especially on the Whitetails from Scratch property. So let's just kick it off. What have you been seeing? Where have you been hunting? What have the deer been doing?
Yeah, it's actually been a good year this year, and you know, I'm judging the year by the success of the work that we've done on the property, not by the fact that, you know, we've killed giant deer. We are holding mature bucks more consistently than we have in the years past. Unfortunately, that means some of our target bucks that we might want to, you know, take out will get pushed out. So, I mean, it's a catch-22. It's a good thing, a bad thing, and we're learning as we go. But yeah, lots of deer action, just no opportunity to actually, you know, let an arrow fly yet.
Yeah, and the number of, upper age class bucks isn't real high. So we got a bunch of just good bucks, and we were talking about it yesterday when we were sitting in the blind, like, you know, we need to be more aggressive. We need to set up some spots that are a little bit better for the rut and this and that, and kind of thinking about some of the things we should have done this year. But then, you know, kind of flipped it and thought, well, you know, we've actually had a pretty good, I mean, you can't be mad about how many bucks we've saved, how many good bucks we've seen survive. So I think there's a lot of positive with the low key approach that we took, even though obviously we haven't shot a big buck yet, but I think there's a lot of good things that have happened. We've been focusing on footage too, which has been huge and a lot of fun at the same time. Seems like you know, you get a big buck to pose, or not even a huge buck, but just like a nice buck to pose and model for you a little bit for the camera. It almost seems like it's more successful or more satisfying than pulling the trigger sometimes. So it's been a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I have to say that, you know, last year because of my injury, we set up, you know, our bat blind, the famous bat blind. And I enjoyed it so much last year, and kind of almost my brain flipped to almost of a research and development in a learning type of a scenario environment there in that blind, knowing that a big buck can absolutely come through there, but it's not the prime spot to kill a 6.5, you know, 5.5, 6.5, 7.5 year old deer by any means. But just that experience and that enjoyment was made me want to go there. And it's very comfortable in there too, by the way. Almost kind of like watching TV. You know, we don't never really hunted blinds before. We've always been in a open tree stand. And JJ started sitting it in that same premise, we're learning about, you know, food and eating habits and throughout the year and gathering content and footage about that and assessing that. And he got hit by that same bug, and he's kind of addicted to the bat blind now and all the footage. That's kind of what he was talking about, I think.
Yeah, some of the things that we've captured, you know, we've had some really good equipment in there. You know, turkeys have been eating the plots in just slow motion. You can, you know, watch this footage back, see like which plants they're eating, like how they're pulling the leaves off of these different turnips and stuff. Different, you know, small game birds, cardinals coming in, eating some of the grain and stuff. Had some deer eat some really strange things on film, which is cool to see how they're, you know, even with that lush food plot in front of them, you know, they're changing it up, eating different weeds that we try to kill and get rid of, and they're in there nibbling on that, and, you know, deer in the hemp rope going, you know, putting the scent in slow motion, and just so much stuff we're just learning and watching. And it's like you can look back and see the season progress through the footage. Like you can see all the lush green, thick, just real moist conditions early in the year, September, big bucks coming in, hitting scrapes. Then you can just like start to see everything dry out. The plots all change. Deer start to change. Behaviors change and different bucks show up. And then now it's like we're shifting into late season. You have the snow on the ground. And it's like if you look back at the footage and you can just, because most of it's from the same location that we're filming, just eye level, you can just see the season progress. And it's almost like you could, I was thinking about this morning, you could almost document like every week from the same location, you could put a little thing together that shows like the progress of a season. And yeah, it's just been really, really fun to document that.
Yeah, you know, it's such a cool perspective when you get on the ground with them like that and you're eye level and you get that long lens on there. And it's such a, it's something that you don't get to see from a tree stand as much. You know, like I love hunting out of a tree stand because you feel like you're out there, like they're around you. You're out there. I'm not saying that you're not out there in a blind, but what it allows you to do is get down on that same level as those deer. You know, you feel like bat blind, for example, like watching that footage, you feel like you're in the plot with them, you know, and you can see so many cool things and pick up like that. One, I think from a hunting standpoint, you know, when you're eye level with a deer like that on the ground, you know, it makes the experience even that much more kind of exciting. And two, from a footage standpoint, man, there's nothing more engaging to watch than, you know, a deer right in your face on the same level, not from above, you know, just really you can learn so much more about the little detailed things. And that's what you guys are trying to do, right? You know, you're doing a lot of research this year on some different things, and that's really cool. I think that's exciting. And I'm excited to hear that, you know, the filming thing has really, you know, been exciting for you guys this year. And hey, the season is not over. Like there's still really good hunting to be done. So let's talk about that. Like moving forward now, when Mike, you shot Little Splitter right around this time last year, even a little later. So what are you guys looking for here coming in the next, you know, week or 2 weeks? And what are the kind of strategies look like around that?
Well, it seems like some of these big bucks are starting to show back up on camera, whether they were locked down or, you know, traveled away for certain periods of the rut. But yeah, this morning cameras were looking real good. A lot of bucks in daylight from all kinds of different properties. So it seems like some of these mature bucks are maybe circling back to that the home range, home property, and it's kind of shifting into late season food and late season strategies with a little bit of rut kind of still mixed in.
Yep.
Yeah, I can tell you from what we've been seeing. So I've been hunting with Adam a few days and then been filming over in Wisconsin too. And I don't want to say that we're shifting completely to late season strategies now, but I have seen the reveals more active on food sources right now. You know, standing beans, food plots. You know, we planted a new food plot on our property here in Minnesota, kind of a test plot that JJ, you kind of developed, and Brian. And the deer are hammering that. I've never seen, I don't think, anything like it before. We went in early. So to kind of give you a background on it, we planted beans there and they failed, you know, whether it was a weather thing or the deer just got in there and hammered them before they could get up. Not really sure, but they didn't come. So we strategized here and JJ's like, why don't you go in and plant this kind of test blend and, you know, try to do a food plot recovery kind of deal. And we planted it and we fenced it and it was planted late, but it came up good. And we pulled that fence down here just probably 2 weeks ago. And when we pulled that fence down, man, the deer are absolutely hammering it. I mean, and the interesting thing that we're seeing right now is from 10 o'clock in the morning until dark, there are 5, 10, 15, 20 deer in that food plot. And it's probably an acre, acre and a half in size, probably an acre. And it's getting destroyed right now. So that's where we're going to focus in the coming weeks, that like our efforts, because with all the does there, we've seen some really good bucks. Adam passed a pretty good 8-pointer and we saw a really good one. We'll focus our efforts there, you know, but the thought process is shifting a little bit. You know, a week and a half ago or a week ago, like, oh, the does are here, so the bucks are going to be here. I think we kind of have gone through that lockdown stage a little bit. Bucks are coming off. They're still going to be searching for those last does that are coming into estrus, as well as, you know, it's just, they're going to get back on. They need to replenish all that energy that they lost during the rut and chasing. So, you know, they're going to be looking for those food sources, especially in the evenings. You know, our strategy has been going around 10 o'clock. That's, you know, we've seen great midday movement, but sit those evenings, try not to get in there in the morning so much anymore, bump those deer off those spots. But really watching the reveals right now, and what the reveals are saying are, you know, deer are kind of keying into those little secluded food sources. And I think that's important too, the seclusion part of it, because like we've talked, gun season is in here in Minnesota. It's been in for what, we had the first one that was 2 weeks long. Then we're into our second one. And yeah, now gun season actually goes here through December 12th with muzzleloader coming in.
Yeah, so muzzleloader too kicks in right away after this second gun season. So
yeah, so the deer feeling that pressure a little bit. I think they're less likely to come out into the wide open where, you know, there's roads close by, or, you know, that felt some of that pressure. So if you have some kind of secluded food right now, it's a great time to be on it.
Yeah, I'm gonna kind of reiterate what you just said there. One thing that I kind of learned just here as this podcast started, and what we were talking about a little bit before we started the podcast, is the plot you're talking about that you fenced in. Okay, we basically had the same thing in the one area, and what we noticed is it was just crazy footage, or crazy activity, I should say, pretty consistent all the way through the season. And now since this cold snap hit and they've been hitting it so hard, we've lost the leaf coverage on the brassica, and it's down to bulb, and the ground's frozen. And so now what we're seeing is that these deer are still behaviorally doing something similar, but the feeding in the plot is maybe a minute or two, maybe a walkthrough. It's very little activity as far as length of time, but the deer are still cruising those edges, staying on the outside of that open, kind of like what you were talking about. And they're still browsing there. They're still eating stuff that we didn't plant. And of course, water. There is some open water because of a moving creek. I mean, we assume there's still some water in there. We're not sure. It's been a dry year and it froze early, but there's got to be some kind of water there. But really, I think they're transitioning. And we set it up this way because we know that there's transition periods. Okay. So we set it up so that, yeah, they come here early, it's social, there's food here, all this good stuff, there's water, but then they go to the hard, heavy grain for this cold weather is right into the travel corridor of exactly what I'm talking about. So we can hunt that same spot or same, you know, very close to that spot all year round because of that strategy. And the fact that you pulled that fence late, you're experiencing what we experienced, what I would say, starting a month ago. Now you're getting that later. So that kind of flipped in my head. It's like, oh, that's, you know, that's a strategy in itself, you know? So
I want to ask a question, and this is a question I think it's asked a lot, and I don't know the answer to it per se. So I think one of the things that is affecting us there, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing because we're seeing a pile of deer. We've seen some good deer in there, but a few of the bucks that we're looking for have not been there. Real regular. That's a green food source. Okay. We have also some standing beans that are a little further to the east. So we're not able to hunt like you're picking, right? This food source is not a transition into a bigger one. Like, you're either hunting grain or you're hunting green. So a big question that I hear all the time coming up here is, okay, what do I hunt and when? Do I hunt green? Do I hunt grain? When? How do I pick, and what does it look like? JJ, what do you think? Like, what are you picking and when are you picking those different scenarios?
Yeah, we were actually talking about this a little bit yesterday because we have our property set up to where more of the green hunts better with a north wind and more of the grain, like standing beans, hunts better with a south wind, which in theory, that's the opposite of what you want.
You want the north
wind, cold fronts to be flipped. You want to be hunting the grain.
Kind of figured it out, you know.
So we're kind of in the same balancing act. I'm trying to figure out like where to hunt. Yeah, typically colder is grain, warmer is green. I think the thing we're going to be testing moving forward is probably smaller, different varieties within one area and try to just transition deer. So if we start with more, you know, a summer mix, headed into the fall mixes with grain nearby. Like if you could ideally get into a position to where, you know, you don't have enough deer to where they're just going to eat all the plots at once and, you know, eat all the turnips, eat all the beans early. Maybe you fence it off. I'm not sure how to do it, but if you could transition them from like a, you know, like a clover chicory into a brassica winter rye into a grain, like that'd be an ideal situation. But yep.
And water, make sure you got open water.
But the reality is that's like very hard to pull off with the size and how you want to move deer and just there's too many variables and you can't consistently plant the same thing in the same spot every year. You got to kind of rotate. So a lot of strategy there, but yeah, I think moving forward, we're going to test like how to transition deer like you're talking about, or do some more grain plantings with greens in them. Try to get the best of both worlds and figure that out too.
You know, Homegrown over there in Wisconsin, they kind of have a different approach to, you know, the whole food plot thing and their designs and things like that. And they do a lot of green in grain. And like right now, this last week, so Wisconsin gun season opened and they've shot some really, really good deer just in the last few days. And not a lot of rut activity, not a lot of chasing, but it's deer coming to those spots. And the beauty of that is they don't really have to guess like green or grain, you know what I mean?
Right.
So they got them both there. They're one and the same. Deer can feed on some green, feed on some grain, like they're coming there. So, you know, they've had a lot of success. You know, I talk about, you know, watching reveals and looking at that too. You know, late season patterns are great. I don't think that we're fully in those late season patterns yet. Perfect example. Opening day, like they had this buck that was on this farm 2 weeks ago and hadn't had a lot of pictures of him, and it was nighttime, and they went and hunted it because they knew, you know, eventually that deer would show up there. And sure enough, 9:30 in the morning, opening day, he showed up, and I mean, he was a stud, 175-inch deer probably. But yeah, so just interesting. And that's what, so if you're asking yourself that question, I think that's a good rule of thumb, to kind of try to go off of, you know, cold weather, cold front, hunt your grain, you know, a little bit warmer, hunt the green. I think the green stuff for us is going to be killer here in the next week, 'cause we're kind of getting to warm up a little bit. It's been cold, like single digits, snow. Now it's starting to warm up a little bit. We're getting some south winds. It's melting stuff off a little bit. I think those tops start to melt off. The deer feel good out moving around in it, and they will go and really go to those greens to get those sugars. And
yeah, we saw a lot of deer hitting kind of those southern exposure areas that were green yesterday, areas that they kind of abandoned the last couple of weeks with all the cold weather and the snow. So the warm up, and we even talked about it in the blind yesterday too, how kind of around this Thanksgiving time period, it seems like there's always some type of warm up at some point at some level, and then deer seem to hit kind of that last few weeks where you can get them on, you know, an alfalfa field or a hay field or, you know, something like that. So there's still that window there too before up here in Minnesota, Wisconsin, wherever it may be up here further north, when we get the deep snows, the ice, the freezing, like that's when the green fields will pretty much, they'll just abandon that type of food. So
yeah,
a little bit of a window here too. And I think some of the bucks are still kind of doing their final laps. And if we do have a warm up, a lot of does go to these green fields, they can go there and find, you know, 20, 30 does in some cases and see if anything's still, you know, actively, you know, breedable, whatever, however you want to say it, but kind of last little window, last little search.
Yeah. So three things went in my head there. One is, we talked about, you know, when the deer go to what food and how they move in the different weather conditions. Well, one thing is to keep in mind is the transition of those weather fronts. Understand how they work. So, like, say it gets cold, okay, and we're saying, yeah, they're going to go to the green in the cold. But you have to remember, when it gets really cold and you get a cold snap, especially up here, it does slow and shut down activity. Okay, so you're not going to get as much activity when you have a longer cold front, and they're not going to move quite as far. You know, it's just less activity. Not that there isn't any activity, but it's less, significantly less than when you, as soon as that snap ends, and it starts to warm up and you get that first warm day, and if you have that, still have green and it's exposed, then you're going to see a more, a larger amount of deer moving when you go from super cold to really nice. You know what I mean? And so just kind of keep that in mind. You know what I mean? Now, when you go at late season, like right now, I would call this mid season. Would you say that kind of mid to late? Okay. Now, when you get late season, when the greens, like JJ's talking about, are no longer even really a factor because you get a lot of snow, it's been, you know, frozen for a long time, the bucks will need to regain that protein. And the protein itself, it's in corn, it's in different things, but beans are super high protein. And once you get a lot of this other food covered up and, you know, the cold is really driven into the ground and the greens aren't really much of a factor at all, I would say I would say that beans late, the later the season, the colder, the harder the season, I'd say the beans become even better and better and better for the bucks, if you will. But now that doesn't mean they don't like the carbohydrates and the fat and the stuff in the corn either. You know what I mean? But I just think beans are just a nice little secret for that late season, you know, as far as that goes. Now, as far as the buck activity goes and their behavior right now, typically earlier in the season when it first starts getting going with a rut and the does start coming into estrus, you know, they like to go to the superstar like we talked about in the previous. And then as they get bred more and more and they're locked on, you know, locked down, lock on, whatever, you know, they go through that process and then they'll just kind of, they'll get nocturnal because of the hunting pressure and everything else, you know. But they'll still hit those places. So there, I saw a study that showed that, oh, deer don't, lockdown's not such a thing because they radio collared a buck and he traveled his corridors. Well, fine. But what good does that do you if he's moving only at 3 in the morning or only at 9 p.m.? You know what I mean? So they get smarter. Lockdown or lock on is a real thing. You see less deer, especially when you get that cold snap in the middle of it. If that happens, you're going to notice it even more. This is my opinion now. And so that kind of happened this year. And so these gun seasons started kicking in. I was reading some posts on social media, and I'm seeing guys who are like, this is not a good year. I'm having a horrible year. And, you know, and you're looking for reasons and for blame and, you know, hunting's not the same and that kind of thing. But, you know, every season's different. You know what I mean? And yeah, food does make a difference. Use it to your advantage if you can. Your terrain has a lot to do with it. And really, your gun hunting, especially the human pressure. There's a lot of guys walking out there with bacon grease smell and, you know, smoking and all that kind of stuff. And your scent has a huge impact on that. So we're creating that nocturnal lockdown type behavior because of hunting season in general. And it may not be you specifically, but it's happening all around you. You know, so you have to kind of keep that in mind. You just got to roll with the punches and do what you can to make it a little bit better. But now, okay, so let's get back on track. The coffee kicking in there, Brian.
Here we go.
So my point was that I was trying to get to is, okay, so now they're locked on these does, they're getting them bred, and we're kind of getting to a point where the does are starting to herd back up. Like yesterday we saw, 20? I mean, not all in one group, but we saw 20 does last night. And it's because we were on the green, like JJ said, and it was the warm-up starting. So we went from that cold snap to the warm-ups, and boom, the woods lit up, okay? So we took that to our advantage, but we didn't see any big bucks, okay? Nocturnal behavior, hunting pressure, locked on, still breeding does, that's part of it. But, and I was saying to JJ, right literally before you said, let's go on the podcast, I'm like, yeah, the big guys are kind of MIA now. I don't know what's, you know, and he goes, nope, he showed up today. So it was a 2-day stint where we didn't see the one we're after, the one of them, the ones that we're after. And I started to panic and get anxiety. Oh man, is he lost? Did he leave? But you know what happened? No, it's just, I think now they got that nocturnal, you know, been breeding a lot of does, a little more tired, a little smarter. And I think what's going to happen next is they're going to start going out and searching, just like JJ talked about. They're going to start, instead of having them dose come to them like normal, it has been throughout this part of the year, the big bucks, the ones that own the woods, they're going to start going out and trying to find these herds of doe just to kind of catch a whiff. Is there anybody left? Is there a young, you know, 1.5, 2.5 doe that's going to come in for the first time? We saw that last night. There was a doe behaving very weird, you know, and she was, you could tell her anxiety was there, but she was a young doe. And I don't think she's come in yet. You know what I mean? I think she's starting to come in for the first time. And she, there's a lot of anxiety, and she was freaking out. And so I think that's that opportunity that these other bucks, you know, a 6.5-year-old big buck isn't going to go looking for, you know, a young doe like that. She don't even know what's going on yet. He's going to take advantage of the experienced ones. You know what I mean? So that's my take on some of those comments.
I think there's a few things that you kind of hit on there. I think the opportunities this time of year, you know, when you talk about chances and opportunities, I think those opportunities, I don't want to say lessen, but they do a little bit just because of the humid pressure, the amount of the movement that's going on potentially at night. Still a great chance to shoot a big buck, but I think that you have to put yourself in those scenarios where you may not have a big buck show up every single night on in a particular spot just yet. They're not on their late season pattern. But, you know, you have to put yourself, if you're hunting, in those scenarios where if a big buck does move, where is he going to move? Probably, take a Little Splitter, for example, last year, right? So you went in there, you killed Little Splitter over a food source, you're coming to a food source. That's where a lot of deer were. There was a lot of does coming out there. It was this time of year, and you put yourself in that position where, okay, I think Little Splitter was doing exactly that. And you could correct me if I'm wrong, but like he was coming there and there's a lot of deer coming there. He's going to check things out, see if there's any, you know, last minute does coming in. He's probably going to go and feed, you know, so there's two kind of reasons for him to be there. And obviously he feels comfortable there. You weren't pressuring him and, you know, he feels comfortable moving in the daylight. Here's a question for you before we get into questions from social media. So you're sitting somewhere and you see a doe that still has fawns with her right now. Does that mean that she hasn't gone into estrus yet? She's gone into estrus and has her fawns back. She's not going to go into estrus. Like what goes through your mind from a behavioral standpoint when you see a doe and she's still got fawns with her right now?
Yeah. First thing it has to do, it's the age of the doe. And then I watch how she behaves around her fawns. Okay. So if it's a bigger, older doe, I've witnessed this over and over and over, and there's always exceptions to the rule, but the big ones right away, they know what's happening, their experience, and they get that anxiety I was telling you about, and they start pushing their does away, and they start pushing the other does away. They just don't want to be around anybody. Now, they're still doing their normal behavior. The does are still following them, but once they kick them out, it's usually within a day or two that they'll go into estrus when this behavior starts. And you can see it. They'll be standing up on two legs, you know, they just get, and you don't notice that normally with them because they're all getting along in this social area. And then she'll disappear. Because remember now, she knows where to go. She knows by scent who the guy is that she wants, the older doe. So now when she shows back up 2 weeks later, and the fawns are dogging her again and kind of hanging around a fawn or two fawns. Now, they will kick the button bucks out and, you know, the younger bucks, for some reason, they just kick them away. It's a natural genetic thing. I don't think they have the interbreeding or whatever it is. But so those guys get kicked out for good at some point in time, those button bucks. And those are the first solos you see when in pre-rut. when you see that one lone fawn, there's a very high percentage that's a button buck. He's all by himself. You know what I mean? And you'll see does with fawns and doing other things, but that button bucks is all by himself because that's just a process they go through. So I hope that answered your question. If it's an older doe, yes. I would say that she's done this time of the year very high percentage of the time.
Yeah, and there's also that time of the year, I think it was a couple weeks ago here, where you start to see like big groups of fawns together. They're all like, all the moms are gone, and they're like, what are we going to do? You see seven fawns come out in a food plot, a bunch of button bucks.
The button bucks bump heads sometimes.
It's like, oh, okay, I know what's going on. Yeah, you know, lockdown for sure. But then, yeah, we're kind of back to the time period now where we're seeing all the fawns come back with the mom hanging back out. That's pretty low key. So I'm assuming that those does have been bred.
Yeah.
That'd be my take.
Right on. Well, let's jump into some questions. So again, we put out on social media, Facebook and Instagram, if you're following the Deer Society, what do you guys want us to talk about? Ask us some questions and we'll try to answer them for you. So JJ jotted down a few questions and we're going to do kind of a little Q&A to end this podcast.
Yeah. First one's about filming, how to become successful filming hunts, and then what to use. Maybe Brian, you can kick into that one.
Yeah, that's a tough one. So that adds a whole different dynamic to everything when you're filming, especially if you're self filming. It can be a challenge.
Can I add something at the beginning of this to maybe lead you in somewhere? When it comes to filming, you have to have the passion to want to film. The priority has to be not about just killing a buck. Okay. And so I just want to put that right up front. If your brain isn't there, don't go out and do it. And don't, you know, try and become a, you know, a movie star or something like that. You really want to capture good footage. And, you know, the best way that we learned how to do is take two people together. You're hunting, you know, it was me and JJ. And so I felt just as much satisfaction out of filming a good buck while he was hunting. You know what I mean? So you have to have that passion of wanting to get that first. That's all I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, that's a great point. That passion, and it's a commitment to doing it. If you really want to be successful at it, you know, there's several options out there. I mean, they make great cameras now that are just like a Sony or Canon Handycam that are 4K. Get yourself a tree arm. You know, they can be really great cameras and give you some really good looks. If you're just getting started doing it, you know, just for yourself. Now we're talking about self-filming just to have to show your buddies or whatever. You know, we use a lot of Tacticam POV cameras, which are great because they're so versatile. You can do a lot of different things with them. They obviously make them so you can put them on your stabilizer, mount them to your gun. Those are great. But we've found the way that we really utilize them is for secondary angle type stuff. We're obviously always running a big camera. But you know, if you can get one of their tree mounts mounted above you in the tree where you can kind of get that perspective where you see everything, you know, if you're not fully committed to doing it, that's the way to go, because all you need to do is mount that camera in the tree, capture your perspective. Then you never have to touch it. It's a one, get the remote, push the button and it's going to record and you can focus on your hunt. You know, so those are really great options out there for a POV, easy type camera to really get some good footage and film your hunt. If you want to get more serious about it, you know, there's lots of DSLRs out there that are affordable. They're a little harder to run if you don't know what you're doing and just getting started. But some of those handy cams are really nice too. If you're going to go with one of those bigger options, definitely get a tree arm. It will change your footage immensely, or a tripod if you're on the ground. But again, there's so many things to go into filming. But be committed to it and get the right equipment that fits the way that you want to film and hunt.
Yeah. Just looking at the end goal, what's, you know, is it just something you want to show your friends? You know, what's the budget? It's a pretty big scale on, I just want to show my buddies. So maybe look at something a little bit more affordable, Tacticams, you know, some over the shoulders, some wide angle stuff that really captures more. You can throw them on your bow or gun, like Brian was saying, which, you know, helps with that impact. And also helps with recovering the deer, because you can see where you're shooting and where you're hitting the animal. Always helpful if you're going to go to that next level, trying to actually produce a hunt. Kind of some of our self filming setups we have with a, you know, the fourth arrow arm with a little Sony handy cam or whatnot. That's a good option for your big camera. And then we're still running the Tacticams, like you said, it's kind of secondary. And then I would say the next level, which is, you know, more expensive, a bigger commitment, is more of that DSLR, some of the long lenses. And it's not easy to self film with that setup. So I've been enjoying doing that, knowing that I'm not hunting, more so just wanting to capture really good content. And if, you know, I'm filming Chris or you, you know, then there's a chance that we're going to shoot something on film with those bigger cameras. But yeah, what's the end goal? It's kind of like you got to figure that out first. and your budget, obviously, too, and then kind of take the route.
Yeah.
It makes the most sense.
I agree with that, Jay. It is, you know, what's the purpose of it? You know, what are you trying to do? Where are you trying to, what are you going to do with it? You know, what's your long-term, short-term end goal, whatever you want to say. And from a layman's perspective, okay, because I am not a good photographer. I'm not a good video person. You know, that's just not my, what I do. I never really focused on it that much, but I started out, you know, filming and getting satisfaction out of filming, getting great shots of deer. You know, to me, I thought they were good, but I don't have that kind of creativity. So there's something that goes past just gathering content, and that's the creativity and the artistic thing and all that, and really understanding your equipment. And so that's a whole nother level of stuff that we're, you know, that we're really not talking about. But I would say that's a professional level. Some people have it and some people don't. I just don't have it. You know what I mean? And because I don't have the passion for it. So that's one high end level. Okay. Now, so I go out and film, and we used to team film all the time, you know. And then we got to a point where it was affecting our opportunities on certain big deer. So we decided to start self-filming. And because the business was growing so much and the opportunity to get out and have two people in a tree stand became less and less and less because everybody was so busy. So then we started self-filming, and then we kind of committed to it. Now, self-filming is a whole nother level of filming, okay? Because you can get great footage. You got to get up there. You got so much gear. You got the backpack full. There's so much going on. There's noise being made. There's all these things. You got to get there earlier, you know, breaking down, getting locked down in the stand, and then just getting the footage alone. If you know you're not going to shoot a deer, it's great learning how to film and frame and, you know, and then my glasses, I can't see. I'm farsighted. Because I'm getting older. Well, I can't see that. So now I got to use peaking. I got to learn that. And so there's just so much to it. How do you flow the camera? Don't over zoom. And I've learned this from you guys because I've been around you. But this is not what I do. This is not what I care about it. But it's not my number one, if you will. So now I'm down to like more of a, what do you call them? Kind of a handy cam, the 4K one that you were talking about. And it has the features of some of the more advanced stuff. So I know enough to get that set up the way it works for the way I film. So everything's pretty much auto except for my focus. Okay. And so that works great. It's a great camera. It's, I can stuff it in the side pack of the backpack on my, you know, my 10-point case. So I don't have to have a separate backpack if I'm in a blind. But anyway, I'm getting a little bit long-winded here. But the point of it is it's easy to film deer when you know you're not going to shoot it. But when you see a shooter and then you got to prep and you got to go through the mindset of the actual hunt piece and still get the film, a high percentage of people, and I will consider myself on that side, the camera part takes the back seat or the lesser priority than the shooting part, because that's the deer that I've been chasing for 2 years. This is the first time I seen him in daylight. Little Splitter was a perfect example of that. I had great chance to get good footage of him, except for one thing. Right where he came out, the angle was oak leaves were still on that tree and it blocked him for the most part. So I had to just zoom out. Was not great footage. Okay. In real life, I'm looking at him and seeing it all happen and unfold. So I'm focusing on the hunt part because this is my chance. And so anyway, my point is that there's just so much to self-filming. It's probably one of the harder things you're going to do. And, you know, if we had a second cameraman in there, it would have been epic footage. You know what I mean?
It's a great question. And I'm going to sum it up before we move on to the next one with three things. One, when you're out there, try to eliminate as many variables as you can when it comes to it. So like, you know, get yourself a tree arm or tripod. Think about the scenarios that could present themselves from the hunting standpoint. Like, okay, if a deer's here, I can do this with the camera. I can do that with the camera. Like, figure all that stuff out ahead of time, because as many variables as you can eliminate, hunting, especially filming and hunting, that will make you more successful at doing it. Second thing is experience. You're not going to go out and be a great, great camera guy or super successful at filming your hunt the first time that you do it. The more experience that you can get, take a camera out every single time you go. If you're passionate about it and you're committed to it, go film other stuff, go practice. Like, there is nothing more valuable in that scenario than experience. The third thing that I'm going to say is that filming your hunt, whether you want to do it or not, I can tell you this, and I promise you it will happen to you. If you commit yourself to it, it will make you a better hunter. Filming makes you a better hunter because if you're focused on that filming aspect, it's like you're engaging with that deer so much more because you're capturing them, you're watching them. I live in that viewfinder when I'm filming. Like, I don't take my eyes out of it. Like, I am intently watching what that deer is doing every single move. And then you can go back and review it and watch it. Just like you guys were talking about with the things that you've learned. You guys have been hunting for how many years? And you're going back and watching the little detail stuff that you can see in this footage. Watching that, understanding, it will help you to understand more body language, deer behavior, what they're going to do when, or be able to predict that. And I have found that filming has made me want a better hunter, and for sure a more patient hunter. It's made me more patient waiting for a good shot. It's made me more patient when I'm looking at a deer when I'm in a hunting scenario and saying, okay, I can predict what that deer is going to do based on his body language. It just, it takes that relationship or intimacy of that watching that deer to a whole nother level. So if you're going to commit yourself to filming, I do think that one of the other benefits is that it will make you a better hunter. So.
There we go. Yeah, nailed it there. I don't think I have anything to add to that. You just covered it all. Next question. How much calling are you doing late season? How far can deer hear your calling?
Ooh, everybody's staring at me. How come?
Because of coffee.
Well, I've been hunting out of a blind quite a bit, so I call probably about 80% less when I'm in a blind. And I don't know why that is. I think it's because I know deer can pinpoint where a sound is coming from. And if I'm making noise out of this big, solid object, that they're going to catch on to what the heck is going on. And so I rarely call at a deer that has a visual on my blind. Now, if they're in the timber, you know, say I'm hunting a food plot. Let's just use that scenario. And I'm in a blind. And they're at a distance in the timber or on the edge, and they can't really tell. You know, they may know that that's there, but they don't think of multiple things like we do. So if they're focused on something completely different than in being in the field looking at this blind, you can call to them. But remember, they're going to go, oh, that was right there. So now if they can look in that plot, and or if it's an open area, and they're going to say, well, there's no deer there. And then you do it again as they are on their mind is focused on that call. And you do it again. Boom, they pinpoint it and look at that blind. You just wise that deer up. And I don't want to be moving my blinds every month or year or whatever. So I, once again, I call 80% less at least when I'm hunting in a blind. Okay. Mostly cold calling, to be honest with you. I haven't had a scenario yet this year where I seen a buck that I wanted to come in to me that I've called to him when I've been in the blind. Now, I've hunted tree stands maybe a week or two before that. Buck came in, drifted off before I seen him, had to get the camera set, all this stuff that's going on, you know. He wasn't quite gone, but I knew he was going to go into dangerous territory. And so I grabbed the call, knowing that he's searching for a doe, did a doe bleat. Meow. Now, this deer's only 40 yards from me in timber, okay? And he was looking a different direction, thinking a different thing. And it stopped him. And I went, you know, more of a estrus. And he just spun around, walked 10, 15 yards from me, got a good look at him. Beautiful 10-point deer, up and comer. I had to think, is that the one, is that, you know? But he's young and he is going to be a stud if he can live a couple more years. He's going to be a superstar. But so in that case, yeah, I was aggressive with my calling. You know what I mean? But I wasn't worried about him pinpointing because now I could take that call and point it where I wanted him to walk. And that's what happened. And he walked right to it. Okay. So calling is really good this time of year. as the hunting pressure and the people get out there and we're hearing rumors of neighbors, you know, rattling every 15 minutes and blowing calls and stuff. Well, unfortunately, it's probably my calls. And so they're going to get call shy. So as a call maker, I shouldn't say this, but I call the least amount as I need to, least amount as possible, but understand, you know, exactly how to more to communicate than to do the calling. But this time of the year, calling can be extremely effective. When they're in rut, I'm using doe bleats pretty much the majority of the time. And then I'll add the buck in there to make the other buck jealous. Now, just the other day, was it last week? We had two target bucks show up. Okay. We didn't catch it right away, but we realized on camera that the one was a target buck. But anyway, this buck walks in. We saw our other target buck in there. JJ could tell the story. And it was a battle. I mean, they went after each other. The one buck is a year older. Must have just smoked him, like, in seconds. Haven't seen him since. So there you go. He must have been getting from going from one doe to another, or kind of being in an area where there was a hot doe. And then this challenger came in and didn't take him hardly any time. Now, yesterday we got one on film. JJ goes, check this out. Just thinking, hey, it's cool to see him again. When I couldn't figure out why he would, you know, send me that picture. So I zoomed in on it and there was blood on the antlers. I'm like, dude, he's not that impressive of a deer. Who would he have beat up like that? But it could be anything. He could have taken a sticker off of the base into the forehead and just started bleeding a little bit. And then some blood got rubbing or whatever, who knows. But so there's still opportunity for calling. Don't overdo it. Be smart how you do it. And that's my take right now, this time of the year, JJ.
Yeah. General thought is, or general rule I use is the thicker area that you're in, the easier it is to call. So I got no problem calling when I'm in nice thick spots with a lot of ground cover, cedars, just thick brushy areas, because the deer can't see and they have to walk around and investigate. They're not going to look right up at you because they're more focused on the ground, especially if you are calling, you know, using directional calling tactics like we've talked about in the past. And then if you got a good setup to where like your downwind side is not easily accessible to the deer too, like if you're in really good setups for calling, there's no reason not to give it a shot or to call the deer that you're seeing walking through and cruising, because good chance you can pull them in if it's the right deer. If it's a buck you want to shoot, but if it's, you know, wide open food source at night and you're on a fence line or something, yeah, maybe not so much. So it's, and I think they can hear a little bit further this time of year too. There's no leaves on the trees, ice on the ground. It seems like it's carrying quite a bit further.
Yeah, if you got like a valley situation, you know, volume, people, don't over volume, because you can't take that back. You know, there could be a deer bedded. We talked about this before, 30, 40, 50, even 100 yards away. And if you're going in there, you know how loud a deer is. You know how loud that sound is where you're sitting as soon as you start making the call. If you are 10 times louder than that deer, there's a chance that you are educating and freaking the deer out, a high, high percentage that that's happening. So if you're doing blind calling, now, if you're rattling, that will carry such a long ways. You know what I mean? So you can kind of get away with volume on something like that. But if you're cold calling, don't get on there with a doe being, you know, don't do that. You know, now you could do like a breeding grunt that's a little louder and a little more aggressive. But if you're going to make it, if the volume thing is too much, you better be doing the right thing.
Yep. You know, interestingly enough, I actually called in quite a few deer last week with Adam, and it wasn't bucks. I called in quite a few does last week, and it was interesting. There was one sit we had, and like we had all these deer, and we're on the ground in a blind sitting over that food plot I was talking about earlier. Tons of does in there. The last thing you want to do is call at that point. But it was getting later in the evening, and those does had filtered off, and they all cleared that food plot, and I gave it about 5 minutes. Let them all go do their thing. And I'm like, man, I'm just trying to paint this scenario. I'm like, okay, if a buck is bedded around here, like I just, again, you're trying to create that illusion all the time, if you can, when you're calling. So I took the black rack, I just kind of hit them together real quick, Like it was more of a smash, kind of like you talked about with those two deer you guys heard or saw the other day. Hit them together quick, little tickle, that was it. Next thing you know, boom, does came back. Like here they all came. Now no bucks showed up, but it was like instant. Whoop, field filled again. Fed for a minute, they went back off. Like, do it again. Did it again. Whoop. It was like all those does came back. And this is I'm doing a little rattling here. Fed there for a minute. Went off. So just interesting. I like doing a little calling this time of year, you know, but to your guys' point, you guys nailed it. Like be careful when you're doing it. Don't do it when the deer are right there and, you know, try to use the correct volume and communicate with them.
Yeah. And like in your scenario there, like if a big buck comes into that plot you were hunting and there's not a deer out there, like what are the odds he's going to get it within range, you know, all by himself? I feel like it's pretty low. So if you can pull them does in, I feel like, you know, maybe he starts bumping them around, pulls into range. Like you got to cover some ground because typically they're walking those, you know, fence lines, tree lines. So calling in does isn't bad if you can get out of your location when, you know, the hunt's over.
And that's just it. Like we had a good one the second day that we hunted and he's cruising that back edge of the food plot. There was no other deer in the food plot at this point. If there was one doe out there, I'm really, really confident that he would at least had to come and break 20 more yards and check it out, you know, but no deer in the plot, like cruise the back and he was gone grunting. And I think there was a doe in the woods that he was kind of checking out too, but yeah.
Next question here. Not having good access into a property, having to go through the center of it to get to the stands. So I'm assuming they're asking for some advice on how to, work around that obstacle.
I think it's a matter.
You got a good property you can maybe relate to because you have some access points that are more through certain areas.
Yeah, I think it's one, a matter of being creative, looking at the grand scheme of things and saying, okay, how can I maximize what I'm doing, that access, any way that you can. The other thing is understanding where the deer are on your property and when. So like, okay, if you have crappy access and you got to go through the center of your property, you probably shouldn't be going in there and hunting every single morning and going in there and blowing your deer out in the dark. Now, that being said, understand where your deer are. If maybe they're out on the neighbors or they're feeding during that time, maybe that's a good time to get in there for an all-day sit and you're not coming out. So I think it's just a matter of looking at your property and going, okay, where are the deer when? And then try to get through that area, the center of your property, wherever it is, when the deer are less likely to be there. I think there's not a real great answer to that, in my opinion. It's just understand what your deer are doing and try to do it. If that's your only option, then try to do it, one, when the deer aren't there, or two, you know, pick windows when, you know, you have some high wind or you have something to cover. You know, we hear all the time about, you know, guys using a train or vehicles or whatever it is, to get into a spot. That's what I mean. Be creative, think outside of the box and try to create some kind of, if there's some distraction or cover that you can use to get in there, if you have to go in when the deer are in there, do it.
Yeah. I think timing is a big thing. Like you said, maybe you don't go, you know, in the morning when it's dark and you're blowing deer out of the woods. If that's your only option, maybe you wait till it's a little bit light and you try to get in a couple hours after light and try to do stuff like that. Another thing I would say is, if you can go in the off season and just try to walk it, you know, different routes and look around to see like what's the most hidden or concealed route. Like maybe it's a little creek bottom or, you know, just an area where you're a little bit off a trail where the deer aren't watching the trail. You can maybe trim your own little trail to get into. So just maybe some small things, try to think where the deer are bedded and try to just work the terrain as best as possible in the off season and try to figure out the best routes. High wind is a good thing. Rain, you know, weather conditions can kind of conceal your entry for sure. But for the most part, it's tough. Not ideal, but there's ways to ease around it, pick your battles, hunt the edges. And then if you got to jump in for some all day rut sits or whatever, you know, maybe pick the best windows to do that. So just a couple tips there, I guess.
Yeah, that's right on. I mean, I was just going back to our experiences with that. You know, we early on, before we were like real savvy deer hunters, and maybe we're not real savvy yet, but I would say as we were transitioning into the whole deer thing, we would be walking in the middle of timber dark 30 in the morning and blowing deer out and this and that. And so we learned as that process. Now we would never even consider doing that, if at all possible, because we have our own land that we can do anything we want to with it. Okay. This was private land of somebody else that gave us permission to hunt. But what we were doing there was our strategy was bucks during the rut were traveling this ridge, and it was a steep up and down ridge, and it was going east west, which helped the wind dominance. So they were traveling these ridges, and they were just trying to pick up the scent of a doe on a trail. So these trails are going up and down the ridges, right? And so the bucks like to travel the length of the ridge to see if they can pick up a hot doe on one of those edges, or maybe a hot doe that walked that ridge too. So that's what they do. That was their behavior. So we wanted to get all the way up in that timber on that ridge, and we were doing it early in the morning, and we were getting away with it by doing some of JJ's talking about his strategy. So we would be in there early. We would clear trails. We'd make sure that there's the, you know, like a little ravine, so there's like high spots around us that we could kind of slide up in there. We're still bumping deer, but it's dark and they're mostly out feeding. And so once we get up in the tree and we get set up, then the activity started. You know what I mean? So they were coming back to that bed area, to that, you know, cruising area and stuff like that, where when the deer were out overnight into the big food, we could kind of slide in there. So that's going to happen. But now we won't even do that strategy right now because we have our own land and we can do it differently. So if you have your own land here, we don't go into the core of the woods. That's the sanctuary that keeps the deer on the property. So if you rethink it a little bit, and I don't know without seeing the land how we would do that with your particular piece of property, but once again, JJ said, hunt the edges, hunt the this and that, you know what I mean? So, and hunt the winds and hunt, but then you can do different things to the property if you have the ability. Create the bedding area, create the flow with the different food sources so that you know what's going on, know where the water is. And if you are going to go interior and hunt that ridge, do it like JJ said, like you said, do it on the right times. Don't go and blow everything up in the morning and blow, you know what I mean? So, and get yourself away so you can get in and out without being seen and get in and out quietly. And scent free is huge. And not being seen when you get up into your stand. And so that's my, based on experience, that is my, now, if you have property that's not all timber and it's pretty wide open and the timber's just in the middle, well, you got a couple problems. One is you go in the morning, you blow everything out of the open area in the food source or whatever, if it's thick bedding to get to the timber, that's a tough deal. So you're going to have to create some kind of corridor or come in some way best possible. Then when you're up there hunting edges, if you are, in the evenings or in that opening, it's tough to get out of there. So there's strategies for that. You know, I mean, it's a deer hunting's not easy.
That's for sure.
Yeah, like you said, it's hard to know what that property looks like to give like specific advice, but I think people would be surprised to know if they saw how low-key we actually hunt the properties that we hunt.
Oh, yeah.
I think most people probably think, oh, they get this big wood sanctuary, yada, yada, yada. You probably get in there and you see deer all over the place and you're hunting right in the middle and so many deer are cruising by, but in reality, we're just like lightly kind of poking in from all sides when we can and playing the wind and keeping 90% of it. And untouched,
that, and part of that's because we don't have it all set up yet. You know, we can set it up so we can be a little bit more aggressive on that range. But I would say that we are maybe human activity hunting 30% of the property of the 200 acres, sound about right. So you got another 70%, which is, well, that'd be 140 acres or over 100 acres that we do not absolutely ever step foot in. Especially during hunting season. That sounds crazy because it's really good, great habitat timber. I mean, really good with lots of resource in it. And we will not go in there.
Next question. Which Osseo gear are you running in 20 to 40 degree temps?
Go. I'm going to say right away, because I'm such a wimp now that I'm getting older, depends on your tolerance. Okay. We had a 20 mile an hour wind at 19 degrees the other day, and it was cloudy, and it was bone chilling cold. Okay. In February, that's not going to be bone chilling cold for us. Okay. But it went from that, if I think the wind chill was 5, so it felt like it was 5, and the next day it felt like it was 0, okay? Then it's warmed up to 30, okay? So I'm freezing my butt off, walking around and doing things, just normal activity, day activity stuff, freezing, getting in and out of the car, going from here to there, freezing, take, you know, putting on layers, go overdoing it. Then I went hunting that day, and I put what I had 5 layers on by mistake. Because I forgot I needed an extra layer for the black and the extra layer for the orange and all this. So I felt like that kid in Christmas Story, man. I was just like a ball. I'm like, oh, I overdressed today. And then it warmed up to 30-something and the sun came out. Now I'm walking around with a sweatshirt and a t-shirt on. So it's tolerance. But it's really wind cut that has makes the biggest difference. And if you don't have a lot of hair like me, you know, keeping the cap on the chimney is monstrous and then around the neck. So doing those things, you know, make a huge difference. But I'm just going to tell you my tolerance is I was hunting. It was 40s, I would say, the 40 degree temperatures. And I was doing my liner. And then I put the lightweight hoodie in the midweight on with the wind cut. And it was a 20 mile an hour wind in the 40s that day, and I was comfortable as could be. Now, when it dipped down into the 20s, and now it's starting to penetrate into your toes and your boots and your hands and everything else, I jumped to the late season and overdressed the first time. And so then I cut it way back. Yesterday, it was just a thin liner and the heavyweight jacket and bib. That was it. So, and I was comfortable all day long. Now I did go to my warmer boots, they're ice fishing boots because my, you know, toes get cold, but you can put boot warmers in if you don't, you know, if you're not in ice fishing country, but that's where it sits for me. And I gotta say, I am just so impressed with that clothing. I just really am, because it's light that, midweight with just the liners when I was warm in that 40s in that heavy wind, it's less bulky. It's just so much comfortable moving around. And I was just impressed. And I haven't put on heavy gloves at all because I get my hands in them pockets and they just stay warm.
Yeah, I just switched a couple weeks ago to that late season suit and I've been wearing, now we've been mostly in a blind, so it's different, right, when so you're out getting blasted by the wind, but yeah, like yesterday I had just one light liner on and then my late season bibs and late season jacket and I was good. But yeah, like hands, I use thin gloves cause I was running the camera. Don't like thick gloves. So real thin gloves. And then I just have hand warmers in my pockets, wearing my ice fishing boots too. Cause I'm not too much concerned about scent where we're hunting, ground scent that is. So that's where I've been. When it was a little bit colder a couple days prior, when it was, you know, 19 degrees with some wind, I did add, you know, extra like nice medium insulation layer under that. So then I was at like 3 layers, and you can potentially put a 4th on, but you know, 3 layers with that late season stuff in the outside keep me pretty warm.
Yeah, just be careful not to overheat in that scenario. But I'm telling you, the hat and the neck gaiter, I haven't even put the neck gaiter on yet because I haven't needed it. But if you're wearing a hat, a stocking hat, and a neck gaiter, and you got like a fleece liner versus a light liner along with a heavyweight, you better not be walking very far to your stand because you will absolutely be full of sweat by the time you get there in 5 degrees.
Well, I'll tell you, so my dressing, I guess, or attire has changed over the years. You know, I used to be that guy that would wear the lightest stuff as possible as long as I could. And like, I love the midweight stuff. I wear the midweight Osseo gear more than anything. But I have switched in, like, typically in previous years, I would try to layer, and wear that midweight suit. I transitioned earlier to the late season stuff this year than I ever have before. One out of comfort and one just out of like, you don't have to have a bunch of layers on, like 25, even 30 degrees. Like I'm probably going to wear those bibs and I'm going to wear the lightest liner that I have under them. And that's it. I'm going to wear a really one light liner under my jacket. That's it. The beauty of that is twofold. You don't have a bunch of layers you got to deal with. If you're walking in, I pack my jacket on my pack, just wear that light liner on the outside. The bibs, they can zip them up or zip them down.
Yeah.
So it allows you to get your boots on easy. But the top zippers allow you to vent your legs. So, you know, you can still put your bibs on. You can vent those almost all the way down, you know, let that air out so you're not sweating so much walking in. I love those bibs. I think they're super comfortable, super warm. You don't feel like the Michelin man. Like,
yeah, if you got a long walk, what I would do is exactly what Brian said, but I would, you know, if you, that hoodie underneath them bibs, dude, that makes a huge difference.
Yep.
So I probably wouldn't even put my heavy jacket on. I just have that hoodie and vent the bibs if I was walking a long way, just to make sure I don't sweat, because you will be comfortable with that hoodie underneath them bibs.
Yeah, so midweight stuff, and then, you know, transition to that late season stuff. You know, I think earlier because it's comfortable and it's not super bulky, and you know, it's got a lot of great features in there that allow you to vent it and be comfortable, you know, whether it's 30 or whether it's 10.
And we had some cold weather that hit us a little bit earlier this year too, that kind of forced us into that system, but never know what the season's going to bring. So yeah, late season suits been pretty money. Next question, how should I know to let a deer go for the next year, hoping it will be bigger, better than the previous year?
That's a trick question. You got to be like JJ and understand what deer are who and really get it. You know, my point here is really know what you're looking at. And it's really hard to do when the adrenaline starts pumping. Seeing a deer on the reveal, especially at night, you see the picture of the deer, you start to identify the deer. That's a great, great, essential tool to understand how to pass and manage deer, because then you can know who they are when you see them. But I promise you, when you see a deer in real life that you've been seeing at night nocturnally, and you see that deer in real life during the day, he has grown significantly because of two factors. One is that the camera doesn't do it justice at night without the light on him. So you're not really seeing the true picture of him. And then when you see him in real life, the adrenaline kicks in. Okay. And then visually, it's so much bigger in real life too. So you have to kind of keep that under control in your mind, and you have to be able to process that. And I'm not as good at it nearly, and that's why I said JJ. JJ's really good at it. When that adrenaline kicks in for me, you know, it's really tough for me to process. And so everybody has. You shoot a deer, and there's a little ground shrinkage there. You thought it was one deer, and it wasn't. I could tell you stories about that, actually. I had a 3.5-year-old deer, but I was chasing the 5.5-year-old. The 5.5-year-old was consistently in this pattern when the stand that I was in. The 3.5-year-old was similar at some level, came through and thrashed into the corn and had like corn crap hanging out of his rack. And so taking the pictures from the video cam, like I was telling you about, and all of a sudden it happened in real life. And it's one of those places where you see the deer, you turn on the camera, it's happening in seconds. And so it was like a real quick thing, probably 15 seconds that I had to be able to look at the deer, analyze the deer, get ready, get the camera going, get the shot. And so this process went on. This deer comes out and I seen him. And then immediately I made the process in my brain. That's the big deer. I'm going to kill him. Went through the process, got everything up. He cleared the edge of the timber into the standing corn. It was just a corridor. He cleared it. I was committed. I pulled back, stopped him, let the arrow go as he was turning, and ended up not getting the deer, but in fact, that deer is still a deer that we know today and chase, so that's good. But it caught right between the shoulder plate and the skin, didn't do any damage to him at all, other than he got owie pretty bad. But So anyway, that particular situation, that's a tough deal, you know? So there's no right or wrong. You know, if you shoot a deer and you realize, oh, maybe it's the deer I shouldn't have shot. You know what? If you were excited in that time and you killed that deer, that was the right thing to do. So keep that in mind. But understand how to age. Understand how to age. Try and learn how to process. And even the most importantly, try to learn the deer that are in your area using these tools if you can afford it. You know what I mean? Not everybody can. And yeah, you know, I mean, ear ratio. One thing I'm looking at more than I never have before is the ratio of the ear with the rack. So this 10 pointer comes in the other day and I had to look, you know, and then I called him back and he walked through and I'm like, JJ, what 10 pointer did I just pass up? And then he goes, explain him to me. And so besides I explained him, and then we knew what deer it was, but that's not the point. The point was, is that why did I pass that deer up? Because instinctually I wasn't sure. And I can guarantee you, your instincts are, if you aren't sure, that's probably the deer you want to pass if you're managing. That doesn't mean you can't get excited about it. And that doesn't mean that all of a sudden, if you do make that decision like I did, I'm going to shoot that deer before I got a chance to really assess it, and you do, that's not a bad thing either. You know, it's not maybe what you optimally wanted to do, but you still shot a deer, a buck that got you excited, you know? And so don't be hard on yourself on that. And don't think you have to shoot a 170, a 190. That's not what the sport is about. But learning the deer, learning to age the deer, and learning how to process that. And the processing part, I'm going to say bases. Start looking at the bases, you know. Get out of that adrenaline and really focus. And Brian, you said you do it with a camera. You can do it with binos if you have the opportunity. How far is the frame outside of the ears? What's the ear ratio to the frame? That tells you a lot. And then even more so, it's the belly sag and all that kind of thing, which can get tough late season because they lose that weight, but they still have a little bit of that body shape. But that's all stuff you got to process in split seconds. And, you know, so it's experience.
How do you know when to let a deer go? I don't think there's a good answer for that. Cause even just looking at deer that we let go last year, all deer have different jumps and different potential, and you kind of got to set your goals first. I think, you know, we've kind of shifted more to like age.
Yeah.
Age. When it comes to shooting deer. So it's not really, doesn't really matter what's on his head. But just two examples, like we look back at, there was a four-year-old last year that we passed a lot, thinking, man, he's going to be a good five-year-old this year. And it turns out he's just not, like he didn't grow at all. So no. There's some deer that just don't grow at all and kind of have, I'm not sure what's wrong with them, genetically inferior or just lack of nutrition or wore down or whatever the case may be. So there's a five-year-old buck this year that's just kind of scrappy looking. Didn't really do much. So we thought, oh, we should pass him last year. He's going to blow up 5 year, you know, 5 year old. That's kind of the magic number. And you kind of look at him this year, like, oh, maybe we'll give him another year. See, cause sometimes they'll take they have kind of a year where they just stunt a little bit and then they'll blow up the next year. You never really know.
Or yeah, here's another thing. And I'm going to, don't mean to cut you off, but this deer he's talking about happens to be the one that had the corn stalk hanging in his head, but we want to take him out now because we know he's not going to get as big as some of these younger ones, like the one I passed. That guy's going to be a super stud. We know that because at three, he's already as big as him, right?
Yeah. So then you have that scenario where that other buck you're talking about, you know, last year as a two-year-old, he's probably, I don't even know how to score a two-year-old 75-inch eight. I don't even know what that kind of deer scores, but you know, now he's 135, so he's gained 60 inches, we'll just say, in a year, you know, just really blew up as a three-year-old. So did we know that last year? That he, because he looked like every other two-year-old.
Yeah,
and also he blew up and was, you know, way better than all the other three-year-olds this year. So
heavier.
There's really no way to know which one to pass.
No, but you got to keep in mind that now this one we're talking about that, you know, didn't grow up, he's going to beat the crap out of these 3 and 4 year olds that we're like, say, got all the potential and we're thinking that he doesn't. So now he becomes the target. So if you go by inches, you pass the deer that, but we're saying, no, we're going by age. We want him out because we don't want them other ones to get pushed out and get killed.
Yeah. So it's just, it's hard to say because there's just so many different factors that you just never know until you see what happens that next year with the bucks. So you can't really make the decision. Plus, I feel like the older the buck gets, just the cooler they get, regardless if they score more or not. Just gaining mass and stickers and kickers. So I always just enjoy seeing them grow. So,
yeah, I mean, and then they grow by
I don't think any pass is a bad pass, I should say.
No, and they go by default too on a pass. Is look at the one that you were trying to chase that you just couldn't kill, that it got 8.5 years old and you wanted him out of their beamer. Watch that video, folks. That's a fantastic, there's over 1 million views, I think, already. But that's the perfect example about passing. He was not trying to pass that deer. That deer was just really hard to get. And he turned from junk, we wanted him out of there, into a superstar buck because of age, not because of rack.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's such a hard question to answer, but you can kind of have an idea. So if you take Beamer, for example, like Beamer ended up from a score standpoint, like 170. Beamer is such a cool deer, and he grew and he continued to grow and is a superstar. But in a different way than any other deer would be. Each deer is unique. You know, we can all guess and gamble and say this deer is going to be that. It's so hard to tell. I think, especially if you're not running a bunch of cameras and don't have history with the buck that you're looking at, it's really even harder to tell. Like if a buck just shows up, like, oh, should I pass him because he could be better next year? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. I think you have to understand what your goals are. What do you want to shoot? What are you out there for? But I think it comes down to more, yeah, looking at his bases, looking at his face, looking at his belly. How mature is that deer? What does his rack look like based on that maturity level? So, you know, I think, for example, we have a deer right now on our property that's, I think he's probably 170. He's a 4-year-old. We know him from last year. He put on a ton of inches this year, but he's got a giant frame. He's got everything. So like giant frame, huge brows, huge G4s. He's a 10. He's got 2 stickers off his G2. That was the buck we said right away. Understanding that he was 4. Hey, this deer's got a ton of potential. We should try to let him go. Now we have the opportunity. Hopefully he's made it this far to keep that deer around for next year. Will he blow up into something special? Can't guarantee that, but all signs lead to that. Now, if that's a deer that just shows up out of nowhere and we don't know that he's 4 years old based on last year having him as a 3-year-old, that's a deer that you probably shoot. Now, you could look at him. His body looks young, like not young. He's 4 years old, but it doesn't have those ultra mature characteristics, right? So that's a hard thing to determine. Now, we'll follow up next year if he makes it and see what he blows up into. You know, it comes down to a couple things. When you shoot a deer or you see a deer that's of that ultra maturity, like they're just a different class of deer.
You don't question it at all.
You walk up to a deer like Beamer, right? Or even Skyscraper or a little splitter, like you pick those deer up and they're different. Like the bases are different. The horns are different. The faces, just the body, everything about them is different. So I think, you know, if that's your goal, you notice those deer, right? You know, but on the other hand, you have bucks that you think are going to do great things and they don't. I will say this. If you're looking to shoot a 200-inch deer, like you're going to pass a 150 because you say, well, he's 4 years old and he's going to be 200. A 200-inch deer has to have those genetics from the start. So like you passing a 3-year-old 8-pointer, chances are, I don't care how old he gets, he's not going to be your 200-inch deer. Those really, really upper echelon deer are genetically, they have the genetics to do it. And you see that at a young age. The bulk of the deer that we're talking about are the deer that have the potential to get to that 160, 170, yep, potentially 180. That's the bulk of the deer that we're talking about. So it comes with age. There's other deer that get it sooner, like the deer we just talked about that's a 4-year-old that's, I think, 170. Again, it's what are those goals? It's looking at their age, looking at their bases, you know, just trying to, there's so many factors that go into that. It's impossible to tell that question. It's a lot easier when you have history with them. But, you know, look at all of those features and try to use them all to make that decision and, you know, hope for the best, set your goals, and, you know, it's what it is.
And, you know, keep in mind, once you start this process of understanding what deer are there, there's just so much to talk about in this here, but
do a whole podcast
on, you know, it. You can do a whole podcast on it, because some of these deer that you let go, would I say, ask you, JJ, what percentage you're never going to kill them because the neighbor gets them or they move off or whatever, what, 60, 70% of them?
At least.
You know, at least. Yeah. So keep that in mind, you know, but if I shot a 170 that I knew was 4.5 years old, and I shot a 170 that I knew was 8.5 years old, it's not even close for me that that 8.5 year old is just a massive, and that's why this got over 1 million views on that particular scenario. You know what I mean? It's just a whole different world, a whole different level. And to Brian's point, when you see a deer like that, you don't even question, do I let him go? You know immediately that is a monster. And when you see that deer, it's like, dude, that thing is, you don't even process it. I hope I get him. You know, you probably get all freaked out by it. And, you know, it's just different. It's a different deal.
For sure. Well, we are running out of time. I know we got some phone calls and some hunting here. I think some of us may be jumping in the stand here this afternoon. So, we're going to end this one. I think lots of good information there. We're going to follow this one up here shortly with some late season tips, tactics, you know, shifting again into more of those late season patterns and really, really cold weather gear and talking about some of those things. So thanks for tuning in. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure you subscribe, download the free Deer Society app, tons of hunt breakdowns, sweet content on there. Thanks for listening. Good luck out there in the woods. The season, as much as it seems like it's coming to an end, still lots of season left and opportunities to shoot a big buck. So good luck out there, and we'll see you next time. Well, I'm a deer hunting man.
Well, I'm a deer hunting man. All our sponsors here at Deer Society are partners whose equipment we know we can trust are going to make you more successful and have a better experience in the field. Products like Illusion Systems, maker of the Black Rack, the Extinguisher, and the Phase Body Odor System. Tacticam, Reveal Cell Cameras, 10-Point Crossbows, Onyx Maps, Osseo Gear, Huiman, and Big Frig.